Hello and welcome to NJ Biz Conversations. I'm your host, Jeff Kanige. My guest today is Thomas Barella. He is the executive director of the New Jersey Black Empowerment Coalition. Thomas, welcome.
Great. Thank you very much, Jeff, for having me.
Well, thanks for joining me. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. Now, I want to talk first about your organization and its mission, which, as I understand it, is to promote equity of opportunity for the state's Black community. What else should viewers know about the organization and your work? What are the most important things you want people to know about you?
Yeah, so there are actually two sister organizations. I lead both a 501c3 and then a 501c4. On the 501c3 side, we are focused on the intersection of policy, inclusive democracy, and civic participation, ensuring that communities are participating in American government and participating in the civic life. On the C4 side, we use research, community engagement, and education to advocate for a more equitable New Jersey so that individuals have the opportunity to manifest their destiny.
Okay, very good. Now, just a little bit about your background. You were an academic and are former director of advocacy and communication for the Urban League of Philadelphia. You left to establish this organization. What was your thinking at that time? What did you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, no. So professionally, I've had a bit of a winding road. Went to college in Philadelphia, had aspirations to go into medical school. Once that didn't work out, pivoted into public health. But I've always had this streak of civic engagement. So while I was working at Rowan University, I started to participate in civic opportunities. I volunteered with the Urban League of Philadelphia's Young Professionals Network and worked my way up the ranks to becoming president of the chapter, which is essentially a young friends group of a nonprofit organization. And from there, I eventually started working for the organization and leading the advocacy work. One of the things that I saw in that work was I started to recognize all the advocacy tools that are available and started to recognize that those tools are not always utilized in marginalized communities. One of the examples, we have overabundance of 501c3s. While 501c3s can do some advocacy, they don't have the same flexibility to advocate like a 501c4 or a political PAC. And so this opportunity to join this organization and found this organization, that 501c4 component was important. It was just an opportunity to think about how do we expand the tools of advocacy to bring a different level of accountability and transparency when we think about government and policy.
Okay. Well, that's actually is a perfect lead-in to the first thing I wanted to ask you about. It's especially timely now, given that we're speaking on October 31st, Halloween. Early voting has just started in New Jersey. It started over the weekend, this past weekend. And your organization has put together a scorecard of legislators. You went through, as I understand it, about 1,000 pieces of legislation and gave grades to every single member of the legislature, the Senate and Assembly. As I understand it, there were 7 areas: education, economics, housing, healthcare, criminal justice, environmental justice, open and fair democracy. And what I'm wondering first is how you arrived at the grades. Did you just look and see? Did legislator X sponsor or support this legislation that is important to us, and therefore he or she gets an A? I mean, what was the sort of mechanics of coming up with these grades?
Yeah, no, definitely. Good question. So we worked with an outside company, Hit Strategies. It's a national polling firm that has experience in understanding the views and feelings of African Americans. When we looked at the methodology, we looked at, in terms of grading, we looked at different component points. We looked at if the legislation was sponsored by, if a legislator had sponsored a bill. So when we did our lit review and looked at the bills that we felt qualified as bills that we felt support our community, we then looked at if those bills were sponsored by a legislator and we assigned a point there. We also looked at if a legislator was on a committee attached to that particular bill, and then we assigned a point based on their vote there. And then if that bill moved on to the General Assembly, then we assigned a point there as well. If a legislator voted for a bill or if they did not vote on a bill, that was, and then we kind of tabulated the score there, and that's how we came up with our rubric. So when we looked at that process, we really wanted to think about what bills are being sponsored, because these are bills that, you know, ultimately when we're looking at our legislation, we're looking at, are they pushing bills that can help our community? And then from there, what votes did they take? At the end of the day, regardless of rhetoric, regardless of whatever messaging that may happen, ultimately the votes are what matters when we think about, does a legislation move from proposal into signage? And so we looked at our rubric from those vantage points. Did they sponsor a bill, and did they vote on those bills?
All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of work. I'm curious, what did you take away from it? What did you learn? Was there anything surprising in what you learned?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest surprise, and I think I didn't really internalize, was the amount of bills that never make it to a committee vote. I think that's something that, I think there's a recognition that there's gridlock sometimes. There's a recognition that there's a lot of competing factors there. But when we saw that, you know, close to 1,000 bills that we looked over the last 2-3 years, 75% of them just get introduced and never make it to a committee discussion. I think that's what's a concern, because, you know, there's an opportunity to look at these bills and then have that good faith conversation as to the merits, the positives, the negatives. But if you can't even have those conversations, then you can't actually, you know, figure out where that consensus may lie, where points may be made on both sides of the aisle related to a bill. You know, that conversation regarding how does the legislators kind of have that tug and pull when we think about, you know, legislation, a lot of times there is a bit of compromise. But the fact that it didn't even make it to that point was a bit of a concern, because ultimately, if we're trying to address some of the concerns that we see in the communities, legislation is one of the ways to do it. So I think that was a big, big surprise for us.
Right. So what I hear you saying is that because of that, it sounds like progress is going to be on these issues is going to be very, very slow. Is that the takeaway?
Yeah, that, you know, we recognize that progress, you know, it is always going to be slow to the bigger sense, but this seems like it's at a greater level, because as we know, being able to create change is a process. But the fact that so many bills do not make it even into that discussion, I think it just creates this perception that, one, it, you know, citizens can see the level of inaction, but then two, when we think about some of the concerns in communities, and we think about how do we solve them, we have the tools in front of us, but if we're not utilizing them, then we can sometimes scapegoat who are the reasons why these problems exist and not realize that we have the tools in our disposal to try to address them.
Okay. Now, just when I was looking over the scorecard, I saw there were a few A's. There were more D's, I think, than A's. So it looks like, you know, the median legislator is going to be what, about a C or a B?
Yeah, we did find about average. Yeah, we did find about average. I think that makes sense. You know, we recognize that, you know, elected officials are going to respond to their constituents.
Sure.
You know, not everyone has constituents that are concerned about these issues. So, you know, politicians are free to vote based on the needs of their constituents. So we do find that by and large, folks feared about average.
Okay. Was one of those seven areas, was one of them more difficult or produce lower grades than anything else? Did anything stand out in that regard?
I would say, I think the thing that probably stood out, and I don't know if we looked at it from the standpoint of like, should everyone have fared better on one policy area per se, but I do think when we think about economics and that area was a concern, just from the standpoint of recent data has indicated that, the U.S. more broadly and potentially in New Jersey, if we try to address some of these racial injustice issues, we potentially could see improvements in our GDP in terms of the performance of the economy. I know both Citigroup and McKinsey had two different studies that kind of brought that to light. So I think that's something that is important, because ultimately there's an opportunity to look at this not necessarily from a moral perspective, but actually from an economic perspective when we think about how do we address some of the racial inequality and some of the wealth inequality, that there's actually an opportunity for everyone to benefit because of those reports that showed improving some of the racial discrimination has the potential to increase the GDP or increase the economy.
Right. Well, that's it's and the Murphy administration, I mean, Governor Murphy campaigned on the notion of expanding the state's economy, but in doing it in a way that promoted equity, as you would want, and fairness. So I'm curious whether you think, given these findings, given the average grade is sort of average, should the governor be pushing the legislature harder on these issues? Particularly on the economics issues that you're talking about with regard to the business community and what the how the state responds generally to economic inequality.
Yeah, I think there's always an opportunity for the executive branch to consider those opportunities to encourage the legislators to do more. I know we just recently saw that the governor announced a task force to look at diverse spending as it relates to Black and Brown businesses. Obtaining contracts. So I think there's an example there of the governor using the tools at his disposal to try to look into these issues. But, you know, but that's a perfect example of where the legislative and executive branch have opportunities to work together, because we know, I think it was in 2020, the legislature voted to commission this task force and highlighted the need for this committee to be explored. And then ultimately now we're here in 2023, the governor has announced that. So I think that's an example. You know, it took 3 years. One could hope that it may have happened sooner, but that may be just the machinations of government. But I think this is where we think we may need to think about how do we accelerate some of these opportunities to address these issues.
Okay. And on the flip side, were you encouraged by any of the findings? Was there any one of those subject areas where the grades came out pretty well and you thought, okay, there's an area where the legislature is making some real gains?
Well, I would say, I think one of the things we saw was just the fact that, in terms of African-American legislators, their opportunity to advocate for, African-Americans and marginalized communities, they definitely took the lead in proposing bills, sponsoring and voting on bills. So I think that was promising there. But I think ultimately, you know, our goal is to hopefully see that when we think about healthcare, when we think about, open and fair democracy, I think there's opportunities to continue to push. We definitely see from the executive branch, Governor Murphy, First Lady Murphy, are looking at issues around maternal health. I think there's an opportunity there because we know that African-American women are disproportionately, and I imagine Latino women as well, disproportionately impacted negatively in terms of childbirth and things like that. So we imagine that there's opportunities there for continued progress.
Okay. Now, have you noticed, did your research, do your work, either this or other work that you've been doing, have you noticed any trends in the way the legislature approaches these issues? Have they been getting better? They've been getting worse? They've been staying the same over the past, since you established this organization and since you've been watching the New Jersey legislature this closely?
Yeah, so this was our first scorecard, so it's kind of hard for me to kind of have, one of the things we're looking at is this scorecard is our baseline. And
right.
So we hope for future years, we will be able to kind of assess the performance of future scorecards and refer back to the original to see if there's some traction there. So I think it's still early for me to make that assessment just because this is a baseline.
Okay. Have you gotten any reaction from members of the legislature, whether they're happy that they got their A's or upset that they got D's?
Yeah, no, I think we did, our reactions definitely span the diversity of opportunity of action, meaning like to your point, we did have some that weren't a fan of the performance that they received, and we had some that did express support that we acknowledged that they were performing well, which is expected. And I think once again, one of the hopes that we are pushing with the scorecard is just a great accountability. We recognize once again that elected officials may have the opportunity to respond to their constituents. Their constituents could potentially be making the argument that these issues are not of priority. And so if elected official feels comfortable in voting that way, that is their prerogative. But once again, we feel that when we think about opportunity, when we think about moving New Jersey forward, it's really about moving all New Jerseyans. And I think this is an opportunity when we think about some of these bills gives us opportunity to do so. And so ultimately, we hope that citizens can take this information and feel more empowered to ask those difficult questions. So if they see a legislator that didn't perform well, they can ask those questions to say, hey, this scorecard didn't see you in a favorable light, what would be your rebuttal? How would you respond to that? And if that puts a little more pressure on legislators to kind of think about their answer, to think about, you know, their performance, I think that is ultimately a win, because it is creating a better, it's creating a different paradigm in terms of how citizens see their relationship with elected officials, particularly those that are marginalized, that may not always feel that their voice is heard. We recognize that those with means, those that are more politically savvy, they're asking these questions, they're having some of these nuanced conversations with elected officials. But for those that are marginalized, they may not always feel confident in having these conversations. And so if our school, if our scorecard allows them to say, oh, I recognize what an A is, I recognize what an F is, I may not know the full context, but I know what an A or an F is. And from there, I can now ask those questions. Hey, you got an A on that. What, you know, tell me a little bit more about why you got an A. What do you think you're doing that makes me feel confident in that performance, so that if I am going to vote for you, I can do it based off of a scorecard versus just off of popularity.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, the more information voters have, the better choices that they're likely to make. And it sounds like this is the kind of thing that would do it, that would, you know, you're armed with something now. You know a little bit about the record of some of these people. And as you say, a lot of voters probably don't pay that close attention to it.
Yeah. And I think that's something to think about, too, because we know for many communities, they don't have the luxury to kind of dig into bills. They don't even have the luxury to kind of pay attention to what's happening in Trenton. So, sure. You know, we vote on November 7th and we vote in all elections, and then we just go about our business. And we kind of have this, we place a good faith effort that our legislators are going to be advocated in as best as possible on our behalf. And so if we see that that's not happening, then it's opportunity for the citizens to kind of return back to their civic duty, but then feel more empowered to ask different questions to hopefully get the answers that they're looking for.
Okay. Now, you mentioned future scorecards, legislative elections this year, congressional and a presidential election next year, gubernatorial election in 2025 with an open seat. are you going to have scorecards available for some of those?
Yeah, so I think one of the things we're thinking about in terms of next steps is definitely thinking about scorecard. I think the timing is going to be critical. One of the points that we saw in our study is the fact that a lot of bills get introduced and don't get voted on. I think that does place a little bit of complication when we think about scorecards, because we don't want to have a scorecard where just a couple of bills get added to the rubric, because it can, you know, tilt the results a bit. So I think that is where we have to ask ourselves, do we do a scorecard yearly? Do we do a scorecard every 2 years? I think those are things that we're now thinking about now, because we want our scorecard to have a nice data set of numbers that can be part of the rubric, so that we're not just taking a few votes and then it skews how people perceive their grade.
Okay. And finally, before I let you go, beyond the scorecard, what are some of your other priorities leading into next year? You know, we're in the last quarter of this year. Going into next year, what are the kinds of things, what are the most important issues that you think you need to work on?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, particularly on our C3 side, as I mentioned, we do have a sister organization, the 501c3. And for us, it's really about education, really emphasizing the importance of voting in all elections, particularly for younger people. We are placing a high priority on younger people to recognize the power that they have. We recognize that for younger people, they are not as aligned to Democrat versus Republican. They are aligned towards issues. And so recognizing that they are thinking about the issues, we want to make sure that we're connecting them back towards how government is part of that process. I think one of the things that we know, younger people, because they have tools, social media tools, they can sometimes believe that they are affecting change via social media. And in some cases they are, but we also have to help them recognize that they have to tap into government and recognize that there's change that can happen within the halls of government. And so how do they use some of the social media savviness that they have and apply that into increase awareness, increase advocacy, and applying increased pressure so that the legislators, versus whether it's the new governor, the potential new governor that we will select in 2 years, or future legislators, that they are responding to their needs. And I think, you know, to your point, 2025 provides a perfect opportunity. We recognize 2024 is going to be big when we think about the presidential election. But sure. As you mentioned, with a new governor being selected in 2025, potentially, there's really going to be an opportunity for young people to kind of flex their civic muscle to show that they really care about what's happening, that they care about the issues. And I think it's exciting to know, and I know Lieutenant Governor Wei recently mentioned at an event that New Jersey young people were the most, had the most turnout out of all young people in the country. So I think there's some very strong promise here in New Jersey that young people are really paying attention to the issues, really paying attention to what's happening. And I think 2025 will be a great opportunity for them to flex their civic muscle.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to watch. I hope you'll come back and tell us a little bit more about what you learn as we go forward here. That'd be great.
Definitely will do, Jeffrey. And once again, really appreciate the opportunity to share our work.
Okay. Well, thank you, Thomas Varela, Executive Director of the New Jersey Black Empowerment Coalition and the NJBEC Action Network. Thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. And please make sure to follow us across social media and on our websites. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you all for watching. Until next time, stay safe, everyone.